fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA
106.5 FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Mr. Dave Martino is co-hosting today, so it's going to be a violent day.
A violent day?
Well, you're Karate Kid.
Yeah, martial arts, yeah.
Karate Kid 3, right?
It'll be all martial arts on the radio.
Oh, boy. I don't want to see that. Good enough of that. Well, we're kind of reliving a case. You know, we did an you weren't with us, but I did an interview like 10 years ago on Kurt Cobain, and the book was called Mysterious Death of Kurt Cobain, Suicide or Murder, You Decide. The authors of that book, Tom Grant and Matthew Richer, and we had Matthew on before. Tom's never graced the show, which is fine with me. So anyway, let's bring in Matthew. So welcome to the show, Matthew.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew, so what's happened over the last years? I mean, you were with Tom Grant, for the book and doing stuff back when you wrote it. And I know I had a lot of problems with him myself. So, and a lot of his explanations and things he said to me during that time, I didn't believe. And talking to a few people, it seemed like he was lying.
Yeah.
So I didn't run with him because I didn't trust him. And I felt like his Soaked in Bleach, he had a lot of things where he voiced over and made up stuff. And when you make up evidence, I just write the person off. I can't.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean.
You know, I can't go that far. I mean, it's already, people make mistakes and people get things wrong and get things right and all that. And that's all good, right? That's part of investigating. But when you actually create evidence, I get worried.
Yeah.
You're too much. So what's happened for you in the last year since we've been on?
Well, not much. I actually do not work. I have not worked on this subject in years. Tom and I started, I think it was 2011, we started talking. I had written a few articles on the death of Kurt Cobain, which I found a very fascinating story. I did. And but I also was kind of thought it never been done that well. And so he reached out to me kind of out of the blue and asked me if I'd like to, write something with him. And so I said, sure, I would be interested in that. And so we were just, for a long time, we were just kind of talking about it and not actually doing anything. And then we started doing some writing about it. And that's when it got difficult. And I started doing some research. I started coming up with some, interesting facts about the case. And then Tom loved my fact-checking on the case. He didn't so much like my fact-checking of him personally. One of the things about, for example, I've worked for people who've run for office before, and one of the things you do if you run for office is you fact-check your own candidate, not because you think that the candidate has had, some scandal or something like that, or just because, there might be something that might not look right, and you have to account for that in advance. And so people do this. They hire fact checkers to investigate themselves in order to account for things. Just to make sure no one springs anything on them, or in case there is something maybe that they have done that they didn't realize they had done and they have to account for it that way. There's all kinds of reasons. But anyway, he didn't like that so much he loved my fact checking of others, not so much of him. He was very resistant about that. And that's, I really regret. Well, I regret all of it, but I regret the book I wrote too, because I kind of wrote this book, and then as I was writing it, and I wrote every word of it, I agreed on a theme with Tom for the book, and a general plot and outline, but I started writing as I was doing it. I started having a counter narrative in my head at the same time, and it drove me crazy, and I just started all of a sudden losing confidence in the book I was writing. It was a strange situation to be in. If I could write the book again today, Errol Morris has a book, A Wilderness of Error, about the Jeffrey McDonald case. A Wilderness of Error is actually a good title. If I were to write about the death of Kurt Cobain, I'd actually think I'd call it A Wilderness of Error, because it is a wilderness of error. And I tried very hard to tame that wilderness and account for those errors. But the wilderness grew more dense, and the errors seemed to multiply as the more I kept working on it. Now, first thing about Tom. Tom lives, at least when I was dealing with Tom, he lives a very hard life. He was living in renting a room from an Indian immigrant family in Lompoc, California, which is somewhere north of Santa Barbara. And he was just renting a room in this family's house and, eating out of a microwave every night, washing his plate in the bathroom. Really tough living. Driving a really old car, and I visited him in this rented room in this family's house, and I felt sorry for him. That was my first mistake. I think he took advantage of me feeling sorry for him. His supporters had a different, and he has a lot of supporters, didn't have this view of him, and I felt a little bit like, when Dorothy goes to Oz and she pulls back the curtain and she finds out that, the wizard is just this guy with a microphone, and I went and I saw how Tom was living, and I just thought, all right, this is not like some hotshot private eye. He's really living in desperate circumstances here. And I felt sorry for him. Despite the circumstances that Tom lives in, he has this kind of messianic sensibility, which I thought was harmless at first. That was a mistake as well. He believes like he's been called to do this. In particular, he believes that he is recapitulating the role of the Old Testament prophet Jonah. If you know the story of Jonah, Jonah is going to, called by God. He lives in, what would be now Tel Aviv, and he's called to go to Nineveh, which is in Iraq, and preach repentance. And Jonah runs from the call and sails all the way to Spain. To run from this calling that God has asked him. And then the whale comes and swallows Jonah up and spits him back on the shores of Nineveh and says, no, you have to do this. You have to go preach to the people of Nineveh. So he thinks of this, like calling out the murder of Kurt Cobain is this kind of calling from God that he initially resisted, but found out that he could not resist it, but he had to do it. So he has this, it took me a while to figure this out. I'm talking to him, but he has this kind of messianic sensibility. And it translates in a kind of like, Alan, this might explain some things for you. It's like he has what one might call, the anointed sense of superiority over the unanointed, or the believer's sense of superiority over the non-believer. You probably encountered this kind of attitude in others before. And this is what makes Tom, one of the things that makes Tom very difficult to deal with. And this messianic sensibility has manifested a kind of Dunning-Kruger syndrome. If you're familiar with the term, Dunning-Kruger is with people with limited skills who wildly overestimate their abilities. Tom, kind of arrogates to himself skills that he doesn't genuinely possess. He thinks he's a writer, but he's not. He thinks he's a Christian minister, but he's not. He thinks he's an experienced investigator, but I was never convinced of that. He thinks he's media savvy. He thinks all these things about himself. At one time on his website, he offered Christian counseling services free online to people. Weird. I mean, it's not a crime. He's, twice divorced. He has three kids with three different women. Not a crime. Don't get me wrong. But it's not exactly the credentials of a Christian counselor. And the thing about being a Christian counselor is, I'm all for people doing that kind of work. But generally, you need training to do that kind of work. You know what I mean? You have to go through some sort of academic or some sort of organizational program, church-related program to do that. You can't just, like, post it online and say, hey, I'm a Christian counselor, Come let me help you. So it was just, things like that just really, made me uncomfortable. I think he still offers $50 phone calls. If you want to talk about the Cobain case, you can call up, pay him $50, and then he'll talk to you for a while about it. This messianism is some people really fall for this. He has some of his supporters are nice people, but some of these supporters, I call them, like, it sounds mean, I know, but I think it's accurate. I call them Tombies. They're almost like these people who are like, they are so devoted to him and they so follow all of his words. They don't question anything he has to say and you can't really reason with them. And this messianism, it's when you have an argument with Tom, if you argue over some point of the case or something else, it's very difficult to have a fruitful conversation with him sometimes if he disagrees with you. Do you know the Monty Python skit where King Arthur fights this errant knight and the guy comes at him and King Arthur cuts his arm off? And then the guy says, oh, it's Tis but a flesh wound. And he charges at him again. And then he cuts his other arm off. And it's like he cuts all his arms and legs off. And the guy still won't admit defeat. You know, he's like, come on, don't run away. And King Arthur just puts his sword in his sheath and just sort of shrugs and just walks off. Well, you know, it's like that. You know, you can use all the logic and all the facts, but he still won't acknowledge, you know, the reality. So it gets very frustrating dealing with him. And a lot of people have had this experience. It's not just me. Tom has something to reveal that he also wants to conceal. And I'm not sure what that's about. Now, he makes this claim that things have happened, that he has information that he's holding back for investigative purposes. It's been 30 years. So, I mean, I think that is just kind of wearing a little thin, this position.
He's waiting for the right moment.
Yeah. And so he's like, this is what it's like when you know, he wants to advocate for the case, but then he pulls back. You know, he presses the accelerator, then the brake. It's like sitting in the back of a New York City cab ride. I couldn't figure out what was going on sometimes. And I almost walked away from it. Now, we met in Goleta, California, and he came up with this plan. I had a plan for the book. I had a rough outline, which is the one I went with. And he rejected that, said he wanted to do a three-book series, call it Murder of Lake Washington, self-publish it himself, and write most of it himself. And he said, and then after I'm done with that, you can write whatever you want. You can have full authority over it. And I just thought it was the craziest idea I ever heard. It's mind-boggling. And so I said, okay, fine, you know, write your three-book series, and I'll give you some help, and then I'll, you know, do it, you know, my way after that. I could not understand it. It was, I think he wanted to make some money. Tom's a very much an instant gratification kind of guy. He really wants a quick buck. He's also not very future-oriented. Like, he's made no retirement provisions for himself or anything like that, for example. I suspected later that the reason why he wanted the three books is because he could get his supporters to buy all three. And therefore make some money quickly from them. It wasn't a lot of money, certainly, but it was to him. So it was just this huge time-wasting activity. Hemingway once said, don't confuse movement with action. And Tom does a lot of movement, things on social media and stuff like that, or this little pointless three-book series and such. And it's his supporters like it. They think it's action. They make the mistake, but it's not. I don't know what it is. It's just movement, really. And it fools some people, but never translates into any action. Now I almost walked away. I just got up. I just got tired of it. But one thing happened, and that was in 2014, Kathleen O'Toole became the police chief from Seattle. Now, I've met Kathleen O'Toole many times. She went to Boston College, as I did. I think her job there was head of the Alumni Association. And I come from a big Boston College family. A lot of people on the West Coast wouldn't understand this, but she's also very involved with Irish organizations such as the American Ireland Fund. I come from a family like that as well. I have dual citizenship. I have Irish citizenship, as does my wife and my children, and most of my extended family does. And I've gone to a lot of the events in the American Ireland Fund, which is the American Ireland Fund is a kind of social organization with people who are Americans who have sort of one foot in Ireland. And it's common in the Boston area for people to have this kind of to be a member of this social and professional circle. So I could get to the Seattle Police Chief very easily if I were to write a book. I could get her to take a look at it. I couldn't resist that. And I thought, oh boy, this is a great opportunity. After she left as Police Chief of Boston, she went to become the national Director of Law Enforcement for the Republic of Ireland. Then after that, she became Seattle Police Chief. And that was when I was working with Tom. Later, around this time, Soaked and Bleached was also being worked on. Now, Ben Statler was the director of Soaked and Bleached. His father is a junior partner in the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Pittsburgh Steelers are owned by a family known as the Rooney family. Particularly at that time, the head of the Pittsburgh Steelers was Dan Rooney, who was the ambassador island for Barack Obama. Dan Rooney and Kathleen O'Toole know each other well, but Dan Rooney's passed away now. So I said to Tom, as Soaked and Bleached was, you know, being worked on, I told him about my connection with the Seattle Police Chief. He didn't seem to like that. That seemed to almost like be like a threat to him. It was weird. And then I told him, you know, this Statler fellow, if he wanted to get, you know, do this film and get the attention of the Seattle Police Chief, you know, he has a very good connection to Kathleen O'Toole. He could just have his father talk to his business partner and say, hey, could you, you know, talk to Kathleen O'Toole for me and have her take a look at my son's film. Tom didn't like that idea at all. He thought, you know, Sattler's not trustworthy. No, can't do that. So I didn't know what was going on. I thought this was nuts. Ben's not trustworthy. We can't let him have that kind of opportunity. You know, he'll screw it up, that kind of thing. And I just didn't. What's going on? You know, I just didn't know. I just thought maybe Tom, sometimes it just seemed like Tom wasn't very bright. Some sort of game was being played. Now, in Soaked in Bleach, Tom received $50,000 for that film. And then he could get a little bit more money after that. Now, he loved the power he had over Ben Statler, who really admired him initially. And I met with them, Statler and Tom, in Los Angeles. And at one point when they were editing the film, and many of the expert witnesses were actually indirectly chosen by me. Norm Stamper, for example, I had read Norm Stamper's book, and I discovered that he was highly critical of the lead investigator in the case. And I told Tom about this, that the witnesses were some of them, like Vernon Gebbers, Vincent DeMaio. I had consulted all of them as I was researching the book. So I provided that information to Tom so he could provide that to Ben. Now, the agreement was, and I did agree to this tacitly, was I was supposed to provide information to Soaked in Bleach. I was supposed to get credit, but I wasn't going to get paid. I went along with that. I didn't really, wasn't that itching to get paid, to be honest. I did want the credit for my research, though. And as I was researching the story, I came to the conclusion that Tom Grant never investigated the death of Kurt Cobain. I mean, no, seriously. I mean, like, they were like some of the most basic questions one would ask didn't occur to him. Like, for example, in the police report, and I got an updated set of police reports and shared that with Foam, one of the reports claims that there was a stool wedged against the door in the greenhouse where Kurt Cobain died, preventing access. So I said, okay, well, why don't we, firemen gain entry into that greenhouse. Why don't we find the fireman and ask him, hey, was there a stool wedge against the door? Seems like a kind of obvious thing to do, to fact check that. So I did. And I was the first person to ever call this fireman and ask him this question. He said, his name's John Fisk. He said, no one's ever called and asked me this before. He didn't know there was any suspicion over the Cobain's death. You know, he said, no, there was no stool wedge against that door. He thought the question was strange. He said, it opened very easily. I said, oh, that's really interesting. Okay, we have confirmation that there was no stool against the door. And so I said, you know, Tom, you said you were up there investigating this. Why didn't you look into this? It just seems like a really obvious thing to do. He was up there at the time. But he didn't do it. Little things like that. He just didn't do, like, really obvious stuff. He later claimed that he did do it, but in fact he did not. It was me. If he wasn't investigating the death of Kurt Cobain, what was he doing up there? You know, I can't answer that question. I don't know. At any rate, I'd not get any credit for my research in the film, by the way. Tom blamed that all on Ben Statler. Not so sure it was Ben Statler's fault, but I don't know. The way Tom operates is he really insists on being central station. Everything must go through him. One has to wonder if that's why things, you know, never really go anywhere. But when I did meet with them in Los Angeles, and I met with some people on the film, it was very obvious that they had no idea really what they were doing. I mean, they were going to interview Norm Stamper. Okay, what did you think of his book? Oh, we didn't buy it. Well, why not? All right, you're going to go interview him, and you didn't even bother reading the book? No, you know, they didn't think it was important. They wanted to interview Vernon Gebbers, who wrote the Guide to Practical Homicide Investigation. He has a lot of articles on how to investigate suicides to determine whether or not they've been genuine homicides in disguise. They didn't buy it. They didn't read the book. They didn't see the point. They didn't do any homework at all. They didn't read anything. And it was really obvious as they were doing this documentary. So I thought, oh, this is going to be a disaster, this film. I actually thought it was going to be worse than it really was. They hired two handwriting experts before obtaining their analysis in the film. They seemed to assume that the film, they were obviously going to agree with them. So that didn't work out with them well. And one thing that they did do, there's a producer, Tom hated this guy, Donnie Icar. Tom hated him because he found out he's making more money on the film than him. Tom was thrilled to get the $50,000 from Ben Statler in the beginning, but then he found out that other people were making more money than him, and he felt really ripped off by Statler. He got really upset over that. Donnie Icar was making more money than him, but also Donnie Icar asked Tom Grant for the original recordings, the tape recordings that when he recorded conversations with Courtney Love and others back in 1994, and he wanted the originals. Well, Tom freaked. He panicked over this. One of the reasons he finally admitted to me why he panicked was because he manipulated those recordings. Now, why did he manipulate those recordings? For example, one of the most damning recordings is from January of 1995, where Courtney Love talks about destroying a suicide note that Kurt Cobain wrote in Nome, an alleged suicide note. Why did he destroy most of it? He said, told me that it was because she was crying and he didn't want the public to be manipulated by her. My guess is probably because there are were things on those tapes that they didn't want people to hear about him. Once you stop manipulating evidence, even inadmissible evidence, you've lost all credibility. The error evidence goes out the window once you start doctoring your proof.
Yeah, because then you're doing it for a reason.
Right, yeah. It's not transparent. But Ben Stiller intervened and overruled Donnie Eichel, so Tom got away with that. So there were a lot of problems with Soaked in Bleach, and I just thought, oh, no one can fix this thing. It was really very obvious. Tom thought it was, brilliant. Soon afterwards, they talked about doing a Soaked in Bleach, and Tom was insistent he was going to get big money for it, He wanted the Icar money, he used to call it. He wanted like $100,000 plus. But they didn't. Apparently, Statler and Grant have parted ways, and they no longer speak. And so I think that whole project just didn't materialize. One thing that they did both do together when they gave an interview with Dave Schrader on Coast to Coast. Dave was very impressed by the book that I wrote and more impressed with that than he was with their film. And there was a chapter in the book. My favorite chapter in the book was chapter, I think it's 52. Again, this is to my point about Tom earlier, not investigating. There was a story where a couple of weeks before Kurt Cobain died that it was reported that he locked himself in a room and threatened to kill himself 2 weeks before he died, and the police had to come to the house and talk him out of the room. Well, no one ever fact-checked the story. So I found the police officer, the detective. He was now later detective. And I got permission from the Seattle police to interview him. I went through all the proper channels. I found the Seattle police to be very cooperative. I said, okay, March 18th, 1994, you were called to the house. What happened when you got there? And, the report says that Kurt Cobain was locked in a room. And the police said, oh, no, we got there. And, he wasn't locked in a room with a gun. He was actually standing in the backyard with his hands in his pockets. He was, deeply embarrassed by the entire incident. His wife had called 911. He wasn't suicidal. He wasn't under the influence of drugs. He was very polite, very apologetic. There was no such incident at all. It was just a kind of big hullabaloo. That never happened. So here I am. I'm getting it on the record from a Seattle police officer that story was false, that he did not lock himself in a room with a gun and threaten to kill himself. And I said, oh, this is great. It was great. I wrote it up, and I really loved the way it read. And Dave Schrader talked about this incident in the interview. But, Ben and Tom, they don't give me any acknowledgement at all. They effectively took credit for them themselves. And I just thought, oh, really? Do you guys have any shame? What's going on? But also, it was also to the point of, why didn't Tom investigate this back in 1994 when he said he was investigating the death of Kurt Cobain? He didn't. Why? Did you investigate it? Or if you weren't investigating, what were you doing? Again, I don't have the answer to that. People want me to tell them what really happened back in 1994. My big answer in general was, I really don't know. I had asked Tom many times, both in person and over the phone, about the day he obtained the suicide note from Courtney Love. This story he tells, it's a really cool story. It turns out that when he did get the note, he contacted this handwriting expert, Sheila Lowe, at about 1 in the morning and asked her to examine it. Well, I didn't know any of this. Tom did not tell me the story. I asked him about it so many times. He didn't tell me. Made up some other story. And so that's why it's not in the book, because I didn't know it. He told some other story that turns out to have no foundation. He said that Sheila Lowe and a second expert named Ray Lyon analyzed a note that was found on the stairs. They did a very poor job, and then that compromised Tom's credibility with the Seattle Police Department. And I think he made up this story in order to come up with an excuse not to pay them. But the story is baseless. And so there were two handwriting experts, Ray Lyon and Sheila Lowe, that he hired in 1994 and then didn't pay them. And I had no idea this happened at all. So I was just so embarrassed when I found that. I spoke to Sheila Lowe on the phone. I said, I had no idea. I'm so very sorry. I didn't know about this. It also contradicts his claim that he was investigating the death of Kurt Cobain on behalf of Courtney Love. Why didn't he just submit these bills to her and have her pay them? One would think she would have paid them with no questions asked. But he did not. Well, why not? My answer, I don't know. You know, did he submit the bills and then pocket the money and not give it to the handwriting expert? I don't know. It's a huge problem in his story why he did that. It goes right to the heart of his credibility. He didn't tell Ben Statler this story either. I still don't know. But at any rate, Sheila Lowe and Ray Lyon, they both confirmed that Kurt Cobain had written the entire suicide note. He doesn't want to admit that either. Another, something came out 4 years ago. Mark Lanegan, who the lead singer of the Screaming Trees, he recently passed. He wrote a book about 4 years ago. Now, in the book I write, Tom picks up Mark Lanegan and a guy named Dylan Carlson. They go out and they look for Kurt Cobain. And then they can't find him. And they drive Lanegan home. And then they go searching, Tom and Dylan go searching for them by themselves. In Lanegan's book, it sounds like it's during daylight. They go to the house, the three of them. Well, this is not what Tom told me or anyone else. And it sounds in the way it's written that they go during the day. Now, it never made sense to me that Tom didn't go back during the day. I asked him this question. If you go and look for something at night and you can't find it, anything, you always wake up the next day and go and look for it during daylight, right? I mean, anything. You lose your house keys. I'll wake up tomorrow and I'll go when it's light out and I'll look for them again. The fact that they never went and searched the house during the day just didn't seem believable. Well, according to Mark Lanegan, they did go and they took Mark Lanegan with them. So they would have known that there was a room above the garage and yet they didn't go and search it? Or did they go and search it? So this story has been out there for 4 years. This book has been out. No response from Tom or anyone else. I don't know what this means, but it's not a story I was told. So sounds like they did go to the house during the day. What did they see? I don't know. I had very trouble. So I wrote the book and I was more interested in the story. And it was wrong of me to do this, but I did it anyway. I put so much effort and time into it. I didn't want to just chuck the whole thing, you know? And I thought maybe I could resolve some of the problems I was suspecting. One of the advantages of a Kindle book is that you can at least edit it and repost it online. So if you find problems in your story, I had a guy named Ron Chepesiak interview me about the version I put up on Amazon. And I rushed the writing of the book, too, in order to get it up before the anniversary of the Kurt Cobain's death. So I put it up on Amazon, and then we were going to search for a publisher. At that point, that was a viable strategy to get a book published. And I was interviewed by a guy named Ron Chepesiak, and he recommended Wild Blue Press because no publishers were interested in it at all. He even contacted them on my behalf and told them they should publish it. So I got an offer from them via email to publish the book. And I thought, Tom and I weren't speaking at that time, but I thought, all right, well, Tom will be happy with this. And I told the Seattle Kathleen O'Toole about it. I said, the only thing I got from the Seattle Police Department really was, okay, your book's going to be published. Well, when it comes out, we'll take a look at it. That was pretty much it. What else could they offer, really, than that? But there was a little window within the Seattle Police Department of opportunity to get this a high-level look, this story. I did that, and so I had this book that I was going to publish with Wild Blue Press. I had planned on changing the book. It was going to make a lot of cuts and some revisions, a different title. It was going to be a slightly different book. But at any rate, I never actually even had a live phone conversation with them, which was weird. Like, everything was by email. We never talked on the computer or on Zoom. It had never gotten to that point. So Tom had later accused me of misrepresenting myself to Wild Blue Press, but I actually didn't really have much opportunity to do that because Tom contacted them and threatened to sue them and said, because I don't know why. It was a deal that didn't pay money, didn't pay in advance. And Tom wanted it in advance, and not too many publishers pay advances. It's very hard to make money writing a book, period. And making money, as you know, it's very slow to materialize. You don't write them to make money. The payouts are very slow. It takes a while. It just does. And I was okay with that. I mean, I was patient. I could wait. I'd never made financial demands on anyone the whole time I was working on this. But Tom, he wanted instant gratification. He wanted a payday. So I just said, you know, forget it. You know, we had this huge disagreement over it. And I said, you know, I put so much time into this. I wasted so much time. I spent money on this. And the fatigue just kicked in so bad. I just said, forget it. You know, I've just got to cut my losses and walk away. So I did that. I walked away. I unpublished the book. And I said, Tom, I'm through. I'm moving on with my life. And I just can't do it anymore. I unpublished the book. I kept it unpublished for a couple of years. And then I heard that Tom was going to put on his own Kindle version of the book, because he had had the first draft of the book, and he had been selling the first draft through his website. Like, the first draft contains a lot of errors, as you know, a book. And so that's all he had, was the first draft. I mean, I combed over that thing 1,000 times to try to catch errors. And he was publishing that first on his website. He published it as a book, selling it to his supporters, and then publishing it as a PDF on his website. You know, I didn't, without my knowledge or consent. And I was actually more bothered. I didn't really care if he made any money off it or sold it. I didn't want any money from him. But I was care. You know, it didn't bother me the wording and things like that, because I know, you know, Tom thinks he's a really good writer and he's not. I spent a lot of time trying to get the words right. So, I just said, forget it, you know, I don't even care. Fine, sell your PDF on your website, whatever. But I put it back up because I heard he's going to put his own Kindle up, version of the book up. So I had to put it back up, but I didn't promote it at all, like ever. In fact, I haven't even apologized to people who bought it, because so much of it depends on what Tom claims he saw and witnessed. And I don't know how reliable that is. I just don't know. I'm not convinced that Tom Grant wants to win. Like, this was one of the startling conclusions I came to. Like, you assume he wants to get this to, or so he claims that he wants to get this into official, to, you know, get this an official look. In other words, this death. This is what he claims. And he's believable enough when he does claim that. But I'm not so sure he does. Here's how I look at it. When I was in prep school, I played football. I was one of those teenagers Kurt Cobain probably would have disliked. I was kind of a jock, so private school jock. He would have probably disliked me intensely, but, you know, we'll let that go. There was this kid on the team, and he would talk a lot, and he said, you know, if only I get out there on the field, I'd show him. I'd do this, and I'd do that, and I would get, you know, and I would, you know, I could get open and I could catch the pass and I could elude the defender. You know, he was always talking about, if only coach would give me a chance, I'd get out there, you know, but he won't give me one, you know. And then one day the coach turned to him and said, you know, out on the field. And he said, I can't, coach. You know, I pulled my hamstring. I can't get out there. Right. So, Tom reminded me of that kid. He talks like he wants to get an official look. If he actually opened the door, if the Seattle Police Department actually said, okay, we'll take a look at this, show us what you have, I think he'd panic. I don't think he wants it to happen. I don't think he wants to win. I think he knows that if he ever got out there on the field, he wouldn't be able to deliver. And I think also there are things like the Sheila Lowe incident and such that might come out that he's worried about. This is why he manipulated the tapes. This is why he doesn't want to admit to going to the house during the day. Did they go to the house and see the body through the doors and have a panic attack and you know, not call the police or something like that? I don't know. Only he knows, and I suppose Dylan Carlson knows. But I don't think he wants to win, because let's put it this way. You had the book, who had a project, which had a very real avenue to get to the Seattle police chief, Kathleen O'Toole. And then you had the film, Soaked in Bleach, which had a very real avenue to get to the attention of that very same police chief. So you had two viable angles to draw official attention to this case, the film and the book, to the same police chief. And Tom got in the way of both of them and didn't want them to happen. It's crazy. Really, I mean, truth is stranger than fiction. And that's why if I were to rewrite this book, I would rewrite it as, you know, something like A Wilderness of Error, because that's what it is. It's a wilderness of error. It's just a huge mess. It's a comedy of errors. Almost everyone who's involved, the medical examiner, the cops, the press, the investigator, the families, the victim, everyone is just engaging in so many acts of incompetence. Now, I do think that Tom probably has some positive motives. I think of it, you know, C.S. Lewis once said that, you know, every vice contains a grain of virtue. And that's why we are sometimes deceived by unsavory people. I think in a similar way, Tom has some positive motives, justice, righting a wrong. I do think those are in there. But those motives are overshadowed by the larger motives of cashing in and self-preservation as well. I think he does want justice. I just don't think he wants to pay a price for it. And I think he's hoping for that something will come along, some opportunity where he'll be able to direct events. But if an official investigation of Kurt Cobain's death ever materialized, you know, it would take on a life of its own. It would not be something that one would be able to direct, right? It would just, you know, you would, it would just, it, that's just the way these things go. So the Soaked in Bleach 2 sequel, I don't think that's gone anywhere, but I have no inside information on that. Tom was working with a guy, I forget his name, but he calls himself the American Spy Fox. Are you aware of this?
No.
Oh, well, this is a guy who's an ex-con. I've never spoken to him, but who was in jail for, like, drugs, kidnapping. He's out of jail now, and he has a YouTube channel, and Tom was working with him now. That's how desperate Tom has gotten, working with this guy. And they did some fundraiser on Facebook, and Tom flew out to Ohio to be interviewed by this guy in person. But then the interview fell apart. Rumor is that they had an argument over the money when they got there to Ohio. They had some argument when they got there, and then the interview never ended up happening. It's a fairly strange story. Now Tom is working with a guy. I haven't watched any of these interviews, I should add, but with a retired Seattle police officer named Neil Lowe, who has written a few books on true crime that apparently well received. But I'm not familiar with him. He's working with him right now, and they have a series of interviews online somewhere, but I've yet to watch them. So, and I don't know what, I have to wonder if this Neil Lowe fellow is being deceived in the same way that I was and that Statler was. Are you familiar with the Isaiah Silva?
I don't think so.
He's the son-in-law of Courtney Love, the ex-son-in-law. So the daughter, Frances Cobain, was married to a man named Isaiah Silva. And Silva claimed that, and I think truly claimed, that Sam Lutfi, who was one of, who was a guy associated with Britney Spears and who was a friend of Courtney Love's, and some goons broke into his house in search of one of Kurt Cobain's guitars. Because Silva and Isaiah Silva and Francis were in the middle of a divorce. And he had a very valuable guitar. And Isaiah feared for his life after the incident was over. And he called Tom. And Tom called me and asked me to help put out a story in the press about this incident. Because there was a police report. And so I did that. I got a couple stories, and I think it was Radar Online, the New York Post. Isaiah Silva eventually cut all ties with Tom. Tom told me that it was Ben Statler who actually told Isaiah Silva not to talk to cut all ties with Tom. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but he cut all ties with Tom and wanted nothing to do with him, and Tom couldn't figure out why. I don't know if he made a financial demand on him or something like that, but Isaiah Silva walked away. There's an attorney that was working with Tom, Kurt Frazier. He was working with him. He has a blog called the Cobain Evidence Blog. He eventually walked away from Tom, cut all ties with him. Ben Statler did that as well. He cut all ties with Tom. I did. I talked to a woman recently named Lisa Anderson who was helping Tom. But Tom asked her to do some sketchy things that she wasn't comfortable with, and so she cut all ties with him. So it seems to happen a lot. Like, people work with Tom, they deal with him, they become very interested in the story, and then they just say, I can't do it anymore.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
They walk away. Yeah. I did it. I'm not the first person to do it, and I'm not the last. It's a tough one, yeah. And he's a very difficult guy to deal with. He can be very gregarious. and likable. Don't get me wrong, but he's a very difficult person to deal with. That's a big reason why the death has gone nowhere. Now the autopsy report, I don't know if you got a chance to look at it, Alan, that I forwarded that to you, did come out recently. Autopsy reports are considered private medical records and only accessible to family in the state of Washington. And it's a really tough looking report. If you've seen it, it's a very amateur report. It almost looks like a high school student could have done it. But the hands were not bagged. They did not perform a test to see if he had fired the gun. They didn't measure the arms. He also ate, the stomach generally expels all its contents into the intestines within about 2 hours of eating. And he had a full stomach as well, Kurt Cobain. He had some meat and vegetables, so within 2 hours of dying. So very interesting. Now, Tom told me years ago that he actually had the autopsy report, then denied saying that to me. So I'm not sure if he's had it the whole time or not. But at any rate, I have talked to some medical examiners about this some of that I've consulted over the years. And they told me they've never heard of anyone committing suicide on a full stomach. But it's not logically impossible. But he would have had to take a very large dose of heroin and then put a shotgun with himself into his mouth within 2 hours of having a full meal. And that suicide note is written on an IHOP menu. So even if we were to concede the Seattle Police Department's case, if we were to concede that it was a suicide, we would have to say, okay, well, he must have gone to an IHOP, had a meal, then gone home, gone up above the garage, smoked several cigarettes, taken a large dose of heroin, a very large dose of heroin, and then put a shotgun into his mouth and pulled the trigger within about 2 hours. So that's, not an easy scenario to sustain. But it's not like there aren't mysteries with Kurt Cobain's death that aren't worth exploring. At the same time, it's such a wilderness of error. It's gone. I don't know what can be done about it at this point. I've certainly given up.
Well, it might be best. Well, we have to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Our time is up. So, okay. Do you want anybody to contact you? Do you have social media set up or a website that you want people to get?
I have social media on Facebook. People sometimes reach out to me, but if they have questions, they're more than happy to ask me any.
Well, Matthew, thank you for being on the show. The Kurt Cobain saga continues. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Matthew.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com.